First off, just so you know, WikiLeaks, if you speak with reporters who worked on it, it really feels like a Rashomon exercise where we each have our own version of how things went. Please know that this is my version of events. Sometimes when you're chained to the documents, you might feel like the man on the lower right corner. I've lived with these for more than a year, and it's been a pleasure to work on them. But I'm sure if you spoke with other reporters, they'll have other ways that they'll talk about how they did their stories, and I just wanted to remind you of that. Okay, the Afghanistan war logs. How this story was first brought to us was, of course, the Guardian had made the connection with the folks at WikiLeaks, with Julian, and had obtained a set of documents that we call the Afghanistan war logs. These are essentially daily field reports filed by often very young soldiers, 19, 20, 21 years old, in the field the day an incident happened. They don't go back and correct their work. They do not look back months later and try to do an analysis. They're just daily field reports. When we got them, we were essentially told from our correspondent in London and some of the people in London that most likely what we'll end up doing is a one-day story focusing particularly on the war dead, possibly other issues related to the war. I got the data just before the 4th of July weekend and began going through it.
And how come it was you who was assigned to this job?
Sure, I was assigned to it because I had done other war-related coverage using databases at the New York Times for both the Afghanistan and Iraq wars in a variety of capacities. I had experience working with military records.
But not with text mining?
With text mining too, yes. I use text mining, and I'll talk about some of our other examples.
Okay.
Right before we got these documents, I had been working day and night on our Gulf oil spill coverage, and that involved a lot of text mining. I'll talk a little bit about that. So I got these documents, and what was very clear was that the one story we could not do with this data was catch the war dead. There were many, many missing reports. There were multiple reports for the same event. For those in the United States, a signal battle was in Tora Bora, where a famous football player, it's for us the football players don't really use their feet, they hit each other. His name was Pat Tillman, and Pat Tillman was killed in Tora Bora. You couldn't find his report. You couldn't find some of the major reports where soldiers were killed. There was also another problem with this material. It was very clear, was that informants were named, and this became a recurring theme. But I began mining this material in ways that it was never intended to be mined. And if there's one thing I hope you all realize, is that when you get documents, just because a government agency was trying to record them for one particular purpose, do not limit yourself and think that you cannot use it for an entirely different purpose for which they were never really intended. So, for instance, I started asking some of the big questions about the war, and I realized that drones, these unmanned aircraft that are used to both do surveillance and conduct missile attacks, often go wrong. There were many reports of drones, crashing into mountainous insurgent held territories in Afghanistan, whereupon U.S. soldiers had to go out and try to desperately retrieve missiles before they fell into the hands of insurgents. Things that were never really reported about in much of the war coverage. The same held true. We had all kinds of great granular detail about the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence agency, and how they were cooperating and working with insurgents in Afghanistan. We learned about things like the shadowy task force 373, which was involved in capture and kill operations, along with other capture and kill operations. So just for an overview, I was part of a team of reporters. It was a secret team. We were not allowed to even let our bosses or any colleagues know what we were doing.
Why?
This material we were conceivably, first off, it was a very competitive story. Secondly, we all faced possible prosecution under national security laws. This was completely different than libel law. We were essentially read our Miranda rights by our in-house attorneys that yes, we can go ahead and do these stories, but know that there is a chance that we could all be prosecuted under national security law. they all wanted to make sure that we agreed with that risk. So we had a collaboration with The Guardian and Der Spiegel, and the cooperation relationships evolved and changed over the ensuing months. It's another panel. But great people that we all kind of shared with. One of the things I started doing with the documents was comparing with other data sets. As I was saying earlier, you know, I have a data set of all major incidents in the Afghanistan war involving U.S. war dead. So those kinds of comparisons proved valuable. So when you see documents, don't be afraid to smash them against other data sets. Again, even though those data sets may not have been intentionally meant for this.
Can you give it as an example?
I will promise you an example.
Okay.
I promise. And then also pulling in other material from, and pulling the other thing too that we tried to do with these reports, and again I'll give you an example, is very often a singular report would tell a whole story, but we also found out, for instance, like with the drones story, that it's like a little bit mentioned here, a little bit in the report over there, a little bit in the report over there, that separately these mentions did not add up to much. But when you combine them together, we believe they told a more powerful story. So this is one of the Afghanistan war stories. We did the initial story. If I can give an example by the way, we immediately rolled into the Iraq war logs story. So to give an example of how we combined other data sets with this, I built a data set of private security firms, these essentially private paramilitary operations that were involved in alleged security operations, but were often involved in battles. And I built that database of more than 100 contractors, smashed it against the Iraq war logs, and we realized what the end result was, that we knew far more than we had ever seen before publicly about how private contractors were engaging in battles. The other thing too, by the way, people talk about how you can use social networking software to tell a story. We found some of the former workers for some of these private contractors mentioned in battles. We found them using LinkedIn Pro. So it was a great way to find former private security workers.
Amazing.
Again, just by way of chronology, shortly after that, we started getting involved with the diplomatic cables. The diplomatic cables were often similar to well-written single-source stories that you might see reporters filing as story memos. Sometimes they were far bigger than that, but let's keep in mind what these cables are. So just like the war logs were stories, field reports by often young military people, the cables were often written by junior embassy people, often just after a single conversation. These single source accounts can be contradictory. So you could read an account one week where they say, we have information that says this about our country, and a week later, a completely different account depending on who the source is. So we wanted to start looking at these in a big way, because the risk of focusing on one cable is that you might ignore other information that clearly the U.S. knew about. So I was developing like things that I wanted to make sure we didn't trip over. We had to realize, of course, that these cables were incomplete. There were no top secret cables. There were, clearly we had more cables from the most recent years, and then it was almost like the half-life of radiation. As you got further out, there was like significantly less cables each year going away. Sometimes, by the way, you benefited from, and I'll talk to you examples of crossing international boundaries. But I think a particularly important lesson is that text often can have a hierarchy. So text, for instance, at the very least, you might often have dates. So you can arrange your documents chronologically. So those of us who have been used to using computers know that we could tease out information about dates. Sometimes, and in this case we had it, documents have locations, so you could begin to map them out. So there are ways that you could begin to analyze tools. The other thing, too, that we realized about the cables is that they had a hierarchy. Not every cable is equal. So, for instance, some cables were simply recitations of the day's headlines. Some junior member of the embassy saying, you know, in El País they had this today, and in this other publication, El Mundo, they had something else today. And so you never knew what was going to be coming from, you know, it didn't mean that that was information, it was just a recitation of headlines. So some things that were great for filtering out or finding the more important cables was for looking for cables that had a higher level of importance. Those labeled, for instance, secret. Those labeled no foreign, which meant do not share with foreign embassies. A demarche was also, or action cable was also important. So the junks were the daily summary headlines. Classifications, however, can be misleading. So even though I'm saying there's a hierarchy, don't think that it's great. You know, it's just like when we file a Freedom of Information request, just because we get the documents doesn't mean it's worth the story. I tried other things too. So for instance, like there would be notations in these cables about when these documents could be released under the Freedom of Information Act. And basically there were some embassies that it didn't matter what the discussion was about, they were not going to be released for 35 years. So even those kinds of measures were not perfect. So sections, whether it was a political or economic cable, and also the authors, we would look at the authors. So all these like little telltale signs that lurk within documents, even though they were in a big document, I started treating as if they were, you know, in the database world, a discrete variable, you know, things that you could begin to do analysis on. But again, a single cable could tell a story, and here was a very compelling cable from Zimbabwe telling about the erratic Robert Mugabe. One thing that's interesting, by the way, to talk about other examples of text mining. So for instance, we recently got hurled into the Sarah Palin email, lose a day of your life story chase. And one of the things that's interesting, and I think this happened both in the WikiLeaks story and it happens in other kinds of stories, is that when you have a group of reporters, even if they're all very, very smart, what happens is that nobody quite knows what the other person did, so we all start tending to search the same phrases through the documents again and again. So if I got this from our web interactive team, the group headed by Aaron Pilhofer. They actually track what people search on our website. And if you look, there are certain phrases that everybody was searching in the Sarah Palin emails. Obama, sex, Todd, you know, McCain. But the thing is, the stories were often on the far end, the words very rarely sourced. So one of the problems you face in text mining and going through documents is that a lot of times the really good stuff is all the way on the long tail. So keep that in mind, and I think the Sarah Palin emails was, you know, one example, but I think the same held true with the WikiLeaks documents.
And then how do you then find the words you actually...
I'll try to answer that question.
Try to be more precise, not just sex, but sex with Obama, you know.
So. Yeah, you could search for sex with Obama, and then you get, you know, you know. So one of the things that we did, for instance, like with the diplomatic cables, is mapped which embassies the cables were coming from. And that helped tell a story, particularly embassies surrounding Iran had a lot of cables, for instance. So this is a quick map I made in, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, showing the concentrations of which embassies were producing the most cables. And of course, you could run this over time if you wanted to see, is there a difference in 2005 versus 2009? So, again, you know, we've all seen these things, these word clouds. This is a word cloud of a bunch of cables. And what happens is that words that don't matter much to us are the ones that pop out. So even when you use text mining tools like word clouds, you look at it and you're like, Russia, government, Georgia, minister. It's like, yeah, you know, that doesn't tell me a story yet. So here is another way that we've done text mining in the past. And we still do it at the New York Times. We have a piece of software called FAST. And I have a love-hate relationship with this software. But one of the things it does is what's known as entity extraction. This is an example from the Gulf oil spill, a series of stories I worked on before the WikiLeaks troves. And if you notice, it gives you all kinds of options where it will try to extract time, it'll try to extract phone numbers, it'll try to extract names of people. and it'll also try to extract companies. So here was a whole bunch of documents that we had gotten through a variety of sources, some secretly, some not secretly. And when you started like doing things, in this case I was looking at issues involving blowout preventers, which was the device designed to be the safety valve in case something was going wrong with the drilling.
Do you happen to know if it also works on the structure in other languages, for instance?
Yes.
Address,
yeah.
Identify addresses, whatever language is it?
I don't know. Yes, in European languages, yes. In Cyrillic, I've never tried it with Cyrillic or, yeah.
Okay.
It tries, but it doesn't always succeed. So places or companies or people's names might get garbled up, but it tries to extract all of these. There's other versions of this kind of entity extraction software that's out there. We, however, could not do use this software for WikiLeaks for a variety of reasons. First off, it takes days, if not weeks, to get massive amounts of documents into FAST. You could kill yourself. These troves here of oil spill documents, took weeks to assemble. Because the software breaks every now and then, you keep having to keep tending and feeding it. When we got the WikiLeaks documents, within a week or two, we were essentially locked and loaded on most of the stories that we were about to publish. So time was of the essence. I didn't have the time to begin to do that. Secondly, it's not secure. And we had to be totally secure with the WikiLeaks material because part of our exposure under the National Security Act is whether we treated the material with kid gloves and made sure that people in the newsroom at large did not have access to it. So putting it in FAST was not an option for a variety of reasons. So essentially, taking these text records and putting into a database is something that's very, very useful. And that's one of the things that we did. And so even though they read like memos, it's also a database. And so dates, locations of embassies, their classifications, are things that was inherent in the data set, but then there were other things you could tease out and create further columns of information. So if you're used to working with a data set, you can essentially start treating raw text as if it was data, bring in these things as memo fields and then begin to extract out these things like places and dates and locations. There is other software out there. Sarah will talk about it. And I found myself, sometimes checking what are some of the other tools out there. One of the things I found really helpful, believe it or not, particularly like at certain stages in the reporting after I'd done some database work and other work, is I would take a chunk of cables and put them into Word. And I found that actually there's a lot of text mining that works like this, where you get a bunch of text, you bring it in, and you start highlighting phrases that are interesting within the groups. And Word, particularly in the 2010 version, lets you have a quick, if you look on the on your left-hand side, has a quick summary of where the highlighted passages might be appearing. So it becomes a quick way of skimming through your documents in the highlighted or searched phrases that you're looking for. It became a quick, cheap, easy tool. Adobe Professional, Adobe also can work like this when you go through a whole bunch of documents and you see their search results. You can set it so that you see the chunk of text where your phrases appear. But Word, because it allows you to see your highlights, becomes a great way, because you have to read this stuff. At a certain point, the machine's not going to do it for you. You have to read it. So I found playing with highlights was helpful in getting things done. So again, I was mentioning earlier that going through various cables and trying not to limit myself to embassies or subjects became very helpful. Here are some of the stories that I found that were essentially little lines in different cables that separately did not add up to much, but together told, I thought, were some compelling stories. We did a story about how the North Korea missile and arms business works, where we could find the European companies supplying the machinery, very precision, high-quality precision machinery to North Korea. We could find how North Korea then sold the missiles. We could then also find how the money got laundered back into North Korea. But all of these were different cables from different embassies around the world. we could see how badly or troubled the Gitmo detainee efforts to get European nations in particular to accept Gitmo detainees was going. We could also see, for instance, this story I loved peeling apart. The DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency in the United States, these cables told us that it was essentially acting as a separate intelligence agency, gathering information, often at cross purposes with what other intelligence agencies were doing, withholding information, and also how diplomats were helping Boeing get a leg up versus Airbus. So here's an example of the North Korea story, how the supplier sold precision machinery from Switzerland, how parts were coming in from other nations like Russia and the Ukraine, and how markets for missiles included the Middle East, and how the money got laundered through U.S. and European banks. Here's the jet story, and again, you know, in the Boeing jet story, you know, sometimes, you know, one cable really helps tell this. I loved how the Turkish embassy said that they would love to buy Boeing jets, but what they would do it in exchange for a astronaut slot on a NASA space shuttle. But what's really important about the cables is not just that people make these remarks, because embassies will write this down, but what you're also trying to tease out is what people say in response. So one of the things I tried to pull out from cables is where there was a comment section. And what I loved in this particular cable was the remark made by the diplomat writing this particular cable. He wrote that we should seriously consider giving Turkey an astronaut slot in exchange for buying Boeing jets. So those kinds of deals were on the table, at least as far as that embassy went. We've worked subsequently with the Gitmo material, WikiLeaks material in other ways. We worked on the Guantanamo files. We've also used it for ongoing stories, whether it involved former diplomats, and like John Huntsman is now running for the Republican nomination for President of the United States. We would mine the cables for analyzing, you know, what he would say while he worked for the Obama administration. And also when the Arab Spring, for instance, was occurring, the cables were good for that. So we mined it a bunch of other ways as well. So those were some of the ways that we went about doing our work for WikiLeaks, and also I hope I provided some glimpses of how we use these kinds of tools for other stories in the past at the New York Times. And I hope you can begin to get a look, particularly when you hear what Sarah has to tell you, because she'll be talking about some of the software that's out there. And I think the real promise is, I don't know what this panel might be like 2, 3, 5 years down the road, and I hope it'll... You know, we'll continue to have to read the documents and make judgments ourselves. We are reporters. But hopefully the software will allow us to become quicker and faster at going through these big piles of documents.
So you're sure you will continue to get this trunk of documents?
I think as reporters, I mean, I was going back and I was thinking, well, how often have I worked with, you know, whistleblowers and leakers and getting secret documents? And I started looking back over my career and I realized I've been doing this for like 15 or 20 years getting documents of this sort. I'm not the only reporter who's gotten leaked documents and, you know, dealt with whistleblowers, so whether large or small, you know, it's happened in the past. I have no reason to not believe it's, you know, not going to happen in the future. And of course, as the internet keeps proliferating, I can't imagine it not continuing to occur.